Oh, this could be one of those coast-to-coast classics. Joe Bullard, our special guest tonight. We're going to be talking about the Bermuda Triangle, and then later on in the program, that incredible location in Florida, built by an old guy named Edward Leed Scullin, called Coral Castle. Joe's next on Coast-to-Coast AM. Joe Bullard was born in Florida back in 1951, attended the University of West Florida, graduated with a bachelor's degree in journalism. He found out about the Coral Castle on television in the series, you remember that, In Search Of. That was back in 1984. And during his time, he was working as a Lake City Community College public information director and a professor of a newspaper class. Joe spent 10 years of research at Coral Castle, started writing his book, Waiting for Agnes, back in 1995. Took him 5 years to get the story on paper, almost 4 years to publish it. We'll talk about Coral Castle next hour. This hour, the Bermuda Triangle as well. Joe, welcome back, my friend. How are you?
Thank you, George, so much. It's great to be back with the...
Always a pleasure.
Man, it's great.
They've been writing me. They've wanted you back, and here you are.
Oh, man, I tell you, when I hear that coast music, I go into the twilight zone, you know?
It does. It's kind of chilling, isn't it?
Oh, everybody loves it. They go, man, I just want a record of that, you know, doom, 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 doom.
Hey, I'm looking forward to updates next hour on Coral Castle, get your take on things. And also, you know, your guess... I mean, we've had so many years for you to work at this, how you think Edward Leed Scullin did his thing. But we'll talk about that next hour. This year, what's new in the Bermuda Triangle area, Joseph?
George, in studying this Bermuda Triangle, you know, if you look at it, and I've studied and looked at it in some different ways, I've always thought, you know, it was a triangular formation. But actually, when you look at it now, the flights and stuff that are disappearing down there, they've actually got there's what they call a typical triangle, linking Bermuda, and it goes right on up into, believe it or not, New Jersey. There's a Devil's Triangle, which is kind of like a trapezoid, and this goes all the way down, extending past Puerto Rico, past Cuba, almost to Venezuela. Then it doglegs, goes back up, and comes out at Tampa. And then a third one comes up here from New Jersey, and it swings around, George, kind of like if a crab was facing Florida with his pincers stuck around the state, that's what it would look like. And it's a huge, wide circle. So it's not just a triangle. It's actually a three-phase thing. And I was just looking at some maps that I had from some notes. And if you look at the disappearances and the rates of it, George, if you take those little Hershey's Kisses and stack them up, the distance between Florida and Bermuda, I mean, it looks like little hundreds of these little dots. And then they start going out towards Bermuda, and they start slacking off. And the things that are going out there, George, you know, there's a lot of people who don't believe in it and stuff. But, you know, anybody in Florida here, man, we grew up with this thing. And there's people always telling you stories about, hey, I went through there on a cruise and saw these UFOs. And, you know, George, we kind of take it for granted now. But there's really something to this. This thing, let me give you the map here. It goes into the Gulf of Mexico, continues through Cuba, Jamaica, Haiti, Dominican Republic, Puerto Rico, the West Indies Islands. Then it comes up through the Bahamas and once more to Bermuda. And, you know, the way this thing got its name, it's been there for, you know, hundreds of years. And when Columbus came through it, you know, the famous story of him seeing the UFO. Well, right. I always thought, George, that he just saw a UFO. You know, it came by. This was a UFO that turned into a USO.
Now, explain that.
Okay. Now, if you go back and look at his documents, and I didn't see the whole true document, but I saw the copies of it, okay, and it's written in his handwriting. And he said, we're sailing along here, you know, all of a sudden it's a night, and we look up. And here comes this, he didn't know any other way to describe it, George, but he said it was a flickering candle, okay? And he said it circled the ship, and we were like, oh, my God, it's this bright light. And then it started pulsating. And he said all of a sudden then from this, I'd say he said about 500 feet up, it just came straight down and splashed into the ocean, okay? He said we saw the splash. But there was no, you know, if you've come from outer space, you're going to have heat on some kind of metal. There was no smoke caused from it, like there was no heat on that UFO. And then he said it didn't just disappear, but it circled the ship underwater at a slow rate of speed, like he was watching what they were doing, and then all of a sudden it just took off.
I love these stories, Joe. I mean, these These underwater UFO stories are some of the best I've ever heard.
They really are, George. And, we just touched on this the last time I was with you, April 3rd of last year. And they give you these little blurbs. They don't tell you a whole lot. They've just discovered a chasm off the coast of Florida that is 20,000 feet deep. Okay? Now, I don't know if you saw this. It was recently in the papers, international papers, but the ex-Canadian defense minister has finally admitted the existence of UFOs.
Okay. Paul Hellyer.
Yeah, Paul Hellyer.
We've talked about that since you were with us last year.
Okay.
An amazing story.
Excuse me. What these guys are saying, George, is that these UFOs are using that channel from Florida all the way up into Canada.
Okay, now this channel, when you say it's 20,000 feet deep, how long, how wide is it?
They didn't really give the report on how wide it was. They just gave the depth. They didn't really give us from say Florida to Bermuda or anything like that. Just like it was like a channel, though, kind of like maybe like 10 rivers wide or something, but nothing really specific. They were just more amazed at the depth of it.
Joel, well, are you saying that some of these disappearances, we're going to get into some of them this hour, in the Bermuda Triangle, are caused by these ET craft, or are we still talking about the possibility of some unexplained Earth phenomenon?
George, we've got everything there. This is a smorgasbord of stuff. We've got UFOs. We've got electronic fogs surrounding barges. You're pulling a barge, and the barge disappears while you're pulling it.
Some things could be natural, some are mystical. So everything is contributing there.
Everything. You've got UFOs that are, these bombers go into a squadron of them and they disappear and they never return.
Why this region, Joe? Is it unusual? Are there any parts on this planet that might be similar to the Bermuda Triangle?
George, there is nothing. There's nothing. If you go and look, and I was just looking through my notes here, there's no other place on the planet where there's this concentration of UFOs. No place.
Weird.
And when you're talking about these UFOs, there's all kinds of people who are here's one of the most amazing ones. I love this one. What they're saying is that when you come to the Bermuda Triangle, there's a replay of past events. Okay, and I'll give you an example. Here's a guy, let's see if I can find my note here, excuse me.
You've got notes all over the place, Joe.
So many books here, man. this thing is amazing. Okay. Anyway, these people were on the Queen Elizabeth II, and they're coming through the Bermuda Triangle. They're coming through from England, of course. Well, they look up, George, and here comes this plane, like a little Cessna, and it's got red and green blinking lights. And they're sitting on the deck, and they look up, and they say, hey, look at that, a plane coming over. Well, all of a sudden, it just dives straight down, George, goes into the water with no splash. And it was so close. I mean, they couldn't read the name on the plane, but they could just see it was a little Cessna Beechcraft, something like that, like everybody uses down there. Well, they were shocked. Everybody on the boat, like 10 people, saw it. So they come back to base. They report it to Miami and all this, and they say, we saw this plane. Can you check your logbooks and see what planes are missing? There were no planes missing.
Hmm.
Nothing on the logbook. And what people are saying, that, George, this is what's fun about this. We don't know. You're sitting there. This is what I love about Coast. We can talk about these things. People can say I'm crazy. I don't care. Because these things happen. What some people are theorizing is that there's some kind of electronic fog or something that traps time, past or future, and that this plane that crashed actually could have crashed 20 or 30 years ago. And you'd have to go back and look in your logbooks and see, was there a Cessna Beechcraft at the time Queen Elizabeth was passing through there when it crashed?
Let's talk about some more of these cases, and then we'll talk about these possibilities of the ET craft, the time warp, this green mist that everybody seems to see in this area as well. What are some of the other episodes that truly are remarkable?
Here's a great one. Now, this doesn't have anything to do with UFOs, but this is the electronic fog that you're talking about.
Okay.
Are you familiar with the Bruce Gernon escapade?
Tell me a little bit more.
Okay, Bruce Gernon is passing through Andros Island. He's heading to Bimini. Okay? This happens like December 4th, 1970. It's about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Now, he sees this, he called it a lenticular or lens-shaped cloud. Now, it's sitting low on the ocean. It's lower than anything they've ever seen before. It's like 500 feet above the surface. Now, there's only one other time, George, in history that a cloud like this has been seen, and I think it was like on the other side of the planet somewhere in Europe or somewhere. Okay, so he's going up. He's ascending. He's trying to get his altitude. So he goes up 1,000 feet a minute. Well, as he looks down at this lens cloud, okay, it's starting to undergo a metamorphosis. It's like it's changing into a huge towering cumulus cloud, and it's rising at the same rate as his plane. Like, it's sitting there. It watches him go up, so it follows him.
That's strange.
Okay? Yeah. Now, so as he's looking around, all of a sudden, the cloud engulfs him. Now, he's flying a little bonanza, okay, which is not real big. And he's starting to go up, and he hits the sky at about 11,500 feet. So he's climbed 1,500 feet, and this cloud just comes up and goes, boom, covers him.
And he's trying to get away from it, right?
Trying to get away from it now because he's thinking, how did it go from down there up here and catch me at that speed? Okay, so he looks behind now, and the cloud that he saw is building into an enormous squall. It's like a semicircle, you know. In this area, George, a squall is like something that the rains came up and the lightnings flash and the skies go dark. Okay, so now he sees another cloud building up in front of him, extending like 60,000 feet up.
Jeez.
So he's thinking, okay, now I'm in between two clouds. Well, he looks around. The cloud that's in front of him is the same cloud that's behind him.
He's right in the middle of it.
He's in the middle of it. Now he says, oh, my God. Now he's got his dad and this other person with him, and they're freaking out. Never seen, I mean, been in Florida all their life. And he says, his dad says, oh, my God, fly around it.
Okay? Now, are we getting radio transmissions from Bruce or anything? How do we know?
Everything is shut down.
All right.
His compasses are spinning. Nothing's working. And it's like he said, nothing fit. He couldn't see the ocean. He couldn't see the sky. There's no horizon. Inside this cloud, there's nothing but bursts of lightning.
Okay.
And all these colors going off, okay? So he says, his dad says, fly around it, fly around it. So he just guns this little bonanza. Well, he curves out around it. As he curves out around it, it follows him. It just, it's like, George, like a big marshmallow that just goes around. You can't get up, down, or around it, okay?
Okay.
Now, as he tries to fly around it, it forms a donut shape, and it extends around him. He described it like he felt like a boa constrictor had flown up there and was squeezing him, because now he looks back, and there's a 30-mile diameter visibility, okay, and only 10 miles in front of him. He can't see anything. Everything is changed.
Now, is he panicking at all, or is
he
in control? Oh, he is.
He's panicking because he's his dad.
That.
His dad is a really experienced flyer. Bruce has been flying like 30 years. His dad, 50 years. You know, I mean, these guys are—they're just out there flying around for fun, and all of a sudden this thing comes up. You know, so now the cloud comes up, George, and it engulfs them. They can't fly over it, under it, nowhere, and he can't get under it because the donut is constricting him like boa constrictor. Now, this is about 4 or 5 miles up, okay? Now, these bright white flashes of light are bursting inside, okay? Now, imagine this. He said, you're in your house. It's a sunny day. You've got your Venetian blinds, and you turn them down so that you don't have any light, and the room gets dark, okay? The plane goes dark. The whole place, like they took the Venetian blind, turned it dark, okay? So now he looks down this tunnel, and about 10 miles away, he starts to see blue sky, and he's like, oh, my God. Well, about this time, George, there's weightlessness. He starts kind of floating inside his plane, and as he's floating, something is pulling him forward, and he's trying to pull himself back in the seat. You know, he's got his seatbelt on, but it's still pulling him real strong, kind of cutting into his shoulder blades. So he looks back now. The walls of this donut that he's surrounded in the middle of are collapsing behind him, like the snake would be pulling his coils on him.
Right, right.
So he's thinking now, oh, my God, this thing's got us. You know, what are we going to do? All of a sudden, the walls that are behind him that are collapsing start forming slits, exactly like you would take your Venetian blinds.
Okay.
Turn that thing, and now you've got slits. And below him is Miami Beach. The cloud disappears. And he looks down. Now, he just left Andros Island, okay, Bimini. That is 50 miles from Miami. It's a 30-minute flight, okay? He looks at his watch. He's been gone 3 minutes.
Yeah, I was going to say.
He looks at his gas tank when they land. He's like, they're just freaking out. They're going, what? And he thinks to check his gas tank. He's got 10 extra gallons.
What did he conclude by all this?
Okay, let me get to this. He said, he said, we went through 100 miles of space in 30 minutes of time in 3 minutes, according to the logbooks. Okay? He, only thing he could figure, George, was that this cloud, somehow, there was an electronic, that fog that he's talking about, that it messes up the compasses. He's talking about time somehow is compressed in the magnetic waves. You know, the compass is spinning and all that. And the only thing he can figure is it's a time warp. Because how can you explain going from there? I mean, this is a man who's been flying all his life, comes from Bimini to Miami in 3 minutes. It's a time warp.
We've heard other stories, Joe, about people flying into this green-type mist, seeing World War II bombers, and these are modern-day pilots who flew into it, and then they fly out of it, and they're gone. It could be something very strange like that out there.
And seeing the Flying Dutchman, some of the ships that they've seen. You remember the Flying Dutchman that
yes.
was supposed to be? Right.
Tell me about this lost Cessna 172, piloted by the woman, Carolyn Cossio.
Oh, yeah, this is a good one. Okay, this is my...
This was back in June of 1964, I believe.
Yeah, let's see. Okay, yeah, that's my number. Yeah. Oh, this is a good one. It's not very long, but now this happened... I think this happened right off of, the lost Cessna. Okay, she's flying along there. She's got a passenger. His name's Richard Rosen. Okay, their flight plan, she was going to refuel at Grand Turk Island on her way from Pompano Beach. She's going through the Bahamas headed to Jamaica. Well, about the time she should have reached the Turcos Islands, the personnel of this small airport, they saw the Cessna 172. Well, she's circling the island. They could hear the voice. She's talking to her passengers, but they couldn't make radio contact from the tower. She was heard to express concern about the gas supply. Now, this happened, ironically, George, also in the Flight 19. At first, the tower and the Flight 19 could talk back and forth. All of a sudden, only Flight 19 could talk to each other, but they couldn't talk to the tower. She's trying to talk to the tower, but they don't hear her. So All they're hearing is she's saying, there's nothing down there. And she's saying, the horizon doesn't look the same. The ocean doesn't look the same. All her compasses, everything starts going crazy, okay? And she said, the last thing she said was, is there no way out of this? All of a sudden, the plane disappears off radar.
And she's gone.
She's gone.
And we never found her.
Never, not anything.
Is it possible that we somehow in that region could be connected to another parallel universe, and that seems to be the portal up there?
You're exactly right. The sky actually, in some of these cases, the sky actually, people watched the sky open, and the plane flew into the open sky and just disintegrated. And I don't mean blew up, but it just disappeared. Now, excuse me, George. On the observers on the Turk Island could see the plane and heard the conversation, but she couldn't hear the tower.
And
so they
gone.
Were saying, through a singular reverse inversion of time, she was in effect looking at Turk Island, but a moment in time before the airport was built.
Jeez.
Uh-huh.
And let's assume for a moment she goes through into a portal, into another parallel universe. What do you think she sees? I mean, is she still there now, flying around? What do you think has happened to her?
I think, well, it's the same thing, and they stopped the transmission. You've probably covered this before about the Admiral Byrd when he's flying to the South Pole.
Right.
You've heard that story where he looks down and sees the prehistoric mammoths and cavemen?
Yep.
Okay, that type of thing, she could very well fly right into a place like that or anywhere, I suppose. And I'm sitting here thinking, well, she's going to land. She's got to land somewhere if she's going through a portal, you know. She's got to land unless she crashes like maybe Amelia Earhart or someone like that. She's got to go somewhere, I think.
Or she's still flying, Joe.
Or she's still flying.
We'll be back with more of these stories in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Joe Bullard, we'll talk a few more cases here, and then we'll get into some more possibilities of the Bermuda Triangle. The Cessna went off into Never Never Land. How about this case? Let's get back to this Flight 19. Okay. Tell me about that one.
Okay. The Flight 19 was five Avenger bombers, torpedo bombers. What they were doing, George, they were on a practice run. And this, I said, this is how the Bermuda Triangle actually got its name. And what they were going to do, it was supposed to be a two-hour run. They were going to leave Fort Lauderdale. They actually took to the skies at like 2:10, and they were going to fly out to Bermuda, and then come back down to Puerto Rico and then back over to Fort Lauderdale. That's what forms the triangle, and that's where the Bermuda Triangle got its name from. However, a few minutes after they got up there, when they were flying through that area, they just about gotten to Bermuda kind of halfway through, and their instruments started just everything going crazy. And there was two guys. The guy who was leading it, Powers, was he was a very experienced flyer, and some of them were students, and some of them were they were students, but they had some good hours in flying time.
They knew what they were doing, right?
Yeah, they were students, but they were only students flying this bomber. They had flown other things up. You know, they had flown in Tarawa and Iwo Jima and all those places, so they had experience, but they just were not experienced in the dive bombing area. So the Navy wanted them to have experience, but all of them were experienced, and his co-pilot was very experienced also. And but all of their instruments started going crazy. And Taylor, Lieutenant Taylor, he's the commander, he starts panicking because after a while, you know, he's supposed to be leading these guys, and none of his instruments are working. So he actually turns over the flight to Lieutenant Powers, which is actually very strange. That just never happens. And Lieutenant Powers did not know that, you know, his instruments, he thought his instruments were working. Well, none of them were working. So, George, they're just out there flying around. And as they're going, they keep reporting back to the tower. They say, the tower says, well, fly northwest, Florida due east. And the guy says, man, we don't know where that is.
Yeah,
and he
yeah,
looks there. Down and he says, the ocean. And here's what gets me, George. The ocean is the ocean. I mean, it's just the ocean. And he says, it doesn't look like the ocean. We can't find the horizon. We can't find the sky.
Well, what does he mean, it doesn't look like the ocean?
That's what I've got a question mark here. What do you mean it doesn't look like the ocean? What, he does not explain it. I think he was so screwed up in his mind, he couldn't even give you a description of what he was seeing.
Because invisibility was okay, right?
Everything is perfect. I mean, you just could not get a better, clearer day.
And then what happened? Did they run out of fuel? Have they crashed?
Well, actually,
where'd they go?
Actually, they are filled up. They've got 100 gallons in that tank. And they're flying, and they're flying. And all of a sudden, the tower keeps telling them, well, fly this way. So they fly that way, but it doesn't bring them in. And after a while, the tower starts talking to them, but they can't hear them. And they get fainter and fainter and fainter. And the tower's going, you know, why aren't you guys responding to us? About this time, as they're flying around, it's getting late at night. I mean, we're talking 6 or 7. They were supposed to have been back at 4 o'clock, George. They're still out there flying around. Still, you know, and this ham operator, I'll tell you this, he picks up this signal, and he says, he hears them talking. And another guy, who was not part of Flight 19, a pilot named Cox, overhears him. He calls Taylor, and Taylor actually hears him. And he says, Taylor, just do this. Follow the sun. Go north. And I'm going to meet you up there. And Taylor says, don't come after me.
Don't Cox, come after me?
Cox, have you heard this part where he says, don't come after me?
No.
Okay. I was going to save this for the last, on the last to finish it up with, but this is too good. They actually, in the transmission, Taylor tells Cox, he says, don't come after me. They look like they are from outer space.
I've never heard this before.
Okay. That's exactly what Taylor says. Now, he's been flying around all this time, and he's never mentioned it. But now he says it seems like he's seeing them. Now, I think somehow they used this disturbance. I don't know what they were doing or why they wanted to capture these guys, but he says, don't come after me. Now, the official version, when it gets back, when Cox reports this, they cut off the part, the Navy cuts off the part that says they look like they're from outer space. And the only official log reports is, don't come after me. Well, a ham operator radio guy happened to be, you know, he was an amateur, but he'd just gotten his set. He flips it on, and here's these guys talking. And he hears Powers, or he hears Taylor say, they look like they're from outer space. Well, he writes all this stuff down and then sends this report in to the Navy. And, of course, they discount it and say, oh, he's just an amateur. He didn't know what he was doing.
And I bet they hide it.
They do. It's not in the official log report. It's only in the ham operator's report to the tower.
And when he was saying they look like they're from outer space, do you think he was talking about craft, or could he see occupants? What do you think?
I think both. I think both. Because when he says they, it sounds like craft and people. He didn't say, you know, the craft look like they're from outer space. They look like they're from outer space.
I keep going back to those scenes from Close Encounters of the Third Kind, Spielberg's movie, where at the end, you know, they let all the occupants that they had abducted or picked up, they let them all go, and they were getting off the craft. Sounds like if this is what's been going on, some kind of craft gobbled up these planes.
Right. I love this. This is Captain Powers' wife. Now, she's the one that Taylor turned over the flight to Captain Powers. Now, she kept trying to get all these reports. You know, all these relatives, of course, George, are going crazy. Like, what do you mean my flight, he disappeared? What are you talking about? So they're all mad. So she started her own investigation, Captain Powers' wife, and she made this report. She said that she believed that some of these victims did not, listen to this, this is your idea, George, they did not die or they didn't disappear from the earth, and they are still alive, probably flying around somewhere. And she bases her opinion partly on her own intuition and on the brief extent of the search, despite the close-by sightings as well as a report of an officer by a local Seminole Indian. These Seminole Indians have reported that they had some ideas of what had happened. Why these Seminole Indians, it's like their intuition. They kind of heard something or saw something in a vision, okay, that one of them had, kind of like Geronimo before, you know, he went into battle. The was it Denver? Custer's Last Stand, I'm sorry. And he had these, you know, intuitions.
Little Bigfoot.
Little Bigfoot. Yeah, Little Bighorn, I'm sorry. And
little
he big. Said that the Seminole Indians
Little Bighorn or Little Big...
Yeah, little Bighorn.
Bighorn, okay.
Yeah. The survivors, listen to this, had been found on the shore in Florida by another government agency, and they were sent to a West Coast military hospital. For years, Joan Powers has tried to track down these rumors, but has generally come up against a wall of official science. She says, my own theory is that the men saw something up there over the triangle, something strange, which jammed their instruments, something which so frightened Lieutenant Taylor that he didn't want Cox, to whom Taylor radioed, don't come after me, to jeopardize his own life for national security reasons. The Navy will not go public with what they know.
Is Powers' wife still alive, do you know?
I think she's dead now.
She would have been a great interview.
Well, that's something we can check on, because I haven't confirmed that. She could still very well be alive.
Now, what year did this happen?
It would have been December the 3rd, 1945.
45, let's say she
December
would have been
5th,
about,
I'm sorry, George.
Let's say she would have been 25 in 45. Man, she'd be 75, 80, 85 years old now. She could be alive.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about it. She'd be a great one.
I want to check into that. What about, and let's talk about the various theories now for a moment, and we'll get into some other cases, and then, my gosh, this hour's almost gone, Joe. We still got to talk about Coral Castle.
I know.
Okay, let's first of all talk about Atlantis. There have been theories that Atlantis sank in the, you know, Bimini area, which is included in the Bermuda Triangle, in that they had some kind of massive crystal. And this crystal is still active, is still functioning, and is pulling down planes and ships. That's one theory. Elaborate on that.
You just stole. I was saving this for a future program.
Sorry.
You have stolen my material here. Yes.
I'm not plagiarizing that.
No, not at all. Not at all.
And you're doing the books on it, not me.
George, that's exactly right. What Casey said happened was, in Atlantis, they had developed, if you can imagine this, take a pyramid, turn it upside down so that the flat base catches the sun. It's like a huge crystal, okay? And the point is down to the earth. They had these laser stations set up, and they believed that what happened was, just like with us now, you know, we get mad at somebody, and somebody flipped one of these switches on, and that force that came out of like a laser beam, whatever you want it, touched off those volcanoes there, and the whole place, you know, it went down in like a galactic type war thing, and that they believe that some of these machines still exist and that are still down there. And the thing that I was going to say, and I've got one other one that I'm going to tell you about, there is a doctor from San Diego, I forget his name now, this was back in the 70s, okay, he's diving off the coast of Bermuda. Now, between Florida and Bermuda, here again, the weather patterns, I mean, it's crazy. George, you got there on the boat one minute, you're scuba diving, and a guy rings you and says, hey, man, we got to get out of here, storm coming up. So this doctor is from San Diego, is down there diving, it's his vacation, he's only got 2 weeks. And so he's discovering this stuff, and they call him, and they say, hey, doc, come out, you know, there's a storm. So they get back in their boat, George. They go back to Bermuda to get in their hotel. Well, they got to wait 2 days for the storm to clear. Now they go back to the area there, right where Casey said Atlantis was, right where the Bimini Wall and those stones and all that stuff are. Well, kind of off to the side of that, I guess I would say. The storms down there are so strong, George, they will blow the sand away off the bottom down there. Well, he goes back. Now, they're on a routine mission. They're not looking to discover anything. Here is a pyramid. Not quite as big as the Great Pyramid, but I mean a big one. The top of it is sheared off, kind of, okay? It's just like sunken in. Have you heard the story, George?
I did.
Gosh.
But I like it better from you.
Okay. I didn't know you'd heard it. I'm sorry. He goes in.
Well, that doesn't mean everybody else has. So
that's true. Okay. So he goes in, and he finds at the top of this pyramid is a set of bronze hands. Now, these hands are joined together at the wrist, kind of like they're holding something. And inside these hands is a crystal ball, about the size of a cue ball, a little bigger, okay? And there's also a rod that's coming down that's still attached to the roof of the pyramid, and it's pointing directly over this crystal ball, okay? And he's like, what is this? So he goes in, and they start tapping him. They say, Doc, the storm's coming back. He has time, and he wrenches this crystal ball out of these hands, carries it with him out of the pyramid, okay? They make it back to shore. Well, he starts studying this thing. And you remember I told you there was an iron or some kind of metal bar running down from the top of the pyramid right so it almost touches the crystal ball.
Right.
Well, as his experiments with this crystal ball, he got to remembering that bar, and he thought, I wonder why it was coming near the crystal. They took an antenna, if you would, off a car, and they put a spring on the end of it so that it would move around, the little end of it on there.
Yeah.
And as they moved this spring towards the crystal ball, George, every time it would come to it, the crystal ball would repel the spring and push it up, push it down. It could not touch the crystal ball.
It couldn't touch it?
Could not touch it. Could not come in contact with it every time they tried to push it. Now, you got to remember, there was an antenna, and on the antenna, they put the little spring, and then they put another piece of metal on the end so that it would float. So every time that piece of spring, that metal with the spring on it came to it, it would push it up and it would float.
So that's a possibility.
Yeah. So
all right,
then what happens is that pyramid gets covered up from the storm again and has never been found.
But it could still be functional. Could be still doing
something.
Could
still be doing there. Yeah.
All right, so one possibility. Time warp.
Through these crystals, yeah.
What's that? Possibility. We just talked about the mist. Let's elaborate a little bit more on that. I think this is a strong possibility.
Okay.
There's a time warp in the Bermuda Triangle. Somehow it's there. People fly into it. People boat into it. And it gobbles them up. Sometimes it brings them back. Sometimes it doesn't. What do you think?
You're right on it. I mean, that's all the evidence. It's right there. George, have you heard of a guy called Hutchison? John Hutchison?
John Hutchison. Sure, the Hutchison Effect.
Okay. Never mind. I had never heard of that, and I just got onto that, and I was like, you know, he's invented a machine. They say that he said if it was tuned to the right way, he could point at a building and make it disappear, right?
Yep.
You've seen that. Okay. I'm thinking this is the same type thing that could be going off. If he can do it, why couldn't the people in Atlantis have done it, like you said, and that thing's still sitting down there causing these things to disappear?
The other one that is very possible, as you mentioned, the UFO theory.
Right.
How many UFO reports are we getting in this area?
Well, there are, at least, and the Coast Guard confirmed this, there's at least one airplane every 2 weeks disappears, and two ships every week disappear.
That we know of.
That we know of. And the Coast Guard reluctantly confirmed that. George, there's stuff going on out there. I mean, it's gotten to be so routine that people don't even report it anymore. It just happens every week. So, since 25 years, there's been more than 1,000 ship and airplane disappearances. 1,000.
Now, you were going to mention some new evidence about the Bimini Road. You know, we've always seen pictures of that. What do you think's going on there?
Well, you know, Jay Manson Valentine is an oceanographer, a professor at the University of Miami, and he was ridiculed when he first discovered this back in '68. Everybody said, "Oh, they've tested it and they've done these things. They've done these core samples and all this stuff." Well, a lot of the scientists that were down there with Valentine were all excited, And they said, yes, this thing is man-made. Well, then all the I don't know who these people are, George, but they come in there, and they got to everybody but Manson and made them recount their stories and say, no, these stones are, they've been there forever, and, you know, sure, they're you know, the ocean has changed their shape and everything. But, George, he's come back recently, and he's found 30 other places where these things are perfect, and there's even, like, it looks like where people had malls that they shopped in.
Almost clearly, then, that these are man-made, perhaps a city that somehow got engulfed by the ocean.
Exactly.
Or these are so far off, it's very possible it was either a sunken island or something else.
Yeah. There was a civilization there. I mean, and now you've got Casey talking about, you know, Casey said that in the beginning of time the pyramids were down there. That was, if you remember this, and a lot of people may not be aware of it, I wasn't, but 10,000 years ago, that whole land base or whole ocean from Florida to Bermuda was dry land.
Well, that's true. You could have almost walked across it,
you
right?
You could have walked across it. So why not a city down there? It gets engulfed in the ocean. Now, this doctor comes along, finds a pyramid with a crystal ball in there. I mean, George, we're just like you said, there's so many things we're not paying attention to. It's out there. It's happening. I believe there's a base between Florida and Bermuda of UFOs, and they're just heading right up to Canada. They're doing their research. They're just ignoring us. Oh, did I get to tell you, George, real quickly, I went to school in Pensacola there at West Florida in Gulf Breeze. You remember when they were seeing all the UFOs there? It was a couple, about 10 years ago. They had a bunch
right.
of sightings. Okay. A man down there, I think he was a doctor or scientist, was on one of the bridges there and actually got a photo of a USO. George, this thing's coming up out of the water. He was only 100 yards from it. You can see the water falling off the UFO.
What about pictures? Why can't we get some great pictures there, Joseph?
This guy's got the picture. I mean, it's in one of the I couldn't find my book tonight, naturally.
Well we got to get it because it doesn't mean anything unless we see it.
It's there, George. He took a, and everybody came along to debunk it, you know, because they kept saying in Gulf Breeze, oh, that's a bunch of bunk. I know people down there that have seen them all the time, fishermen. George, we've gone through there many times fishing.
Oh, there's the huge Gulf Breeze reports. I mean, they're just massive down in that area. Are you saying it's ongoing?
It's ongoing all the time. People, fishermen, they just ignore them anymore. They don't even report them.
Well, Charles Berlitz would turn over on this one, wouldn't he?
Oh, for sure. I'm going to dig up that picture if I can find it and send it to you, because you can see the seawater falling off of this. I mean, this USO, George, has gone up about, it's not only, it's probably 50 feet out of the water. And the guy goes click, click, and got it perfect.
All right, give me your best theory in a minute we have left, what you think the Bermuda Triangle is.
I think it's a base. I think it's a UFO base. I think that there's, like you said, the electronic fogs. I think there's time warps. There's time bends. I think these UFOs are returning from a lost time. When Atlantis is destroyed, they leave the Earth because they say, hey, we can't get along with anybody down there. Now they're coming back to see how the Earth is progressing or degressing.
You might be right, Joe. When we come back, we'll talk about Coral Castle. We're going to Florida to look at the work of Edward Leeds Scullin. Joe, let's talk about Coral Castle, Edward Leeds Scullin. Of course, you documented a lot of this in your book, Waiting for Agnes, and you're about ready to tell us who Agnes was, aren't you?
Yes. Agnes was the girl that Ed fell in love with. He was, as we've talked many times before, sickly as a child and didn't get a chance to date much, George, but she was 16, he was 26, that 16-year-old love, you know. She jilted him the night before the wedding, broke his heart.
And it was somewhat legal then, right? 16 years old. Nowadays, you don't even want to think about that.
Right. Some days back in those days, you know, it was 13 or 14. They didn't think anything about it because they got married. They weren't fooling around. They actually got married. So he traveled to Canada. He was trying to beat the blues.
He was from Latvia?
Latvia, yes.
Okay.
And actually, George, I've just found out some new information since I talked to you last time. I was under the opinion that he actually sailed directly from Canada down to Miami, but he did not. He actually got off in New York, came through Ellis Island. He walked, George, from New York down to Florida City.
Oh, come on. Nobody would walk like that.
I had an email from a fellow who said, I heard you last time on Coast to Coast, and you almost got the story right. So he left the phone, and I called him, and I said, what do you mean? He said, well, this is a weird story. He said, my dad used to work downtown Jacksonville. And he said, this was, back in the 1918, and he said, very few people had cars. So everybody walked. He said, so my dad is walking from his little suburb home there to Jacksonville, and he keeps seeing this little fella. He thought it was a boy at first. The guy was so small. And he's walking along there with a reaching rod. And so one day my dad stopped, and he said, you know, I mean, I don't mean to pry into your business, but what are you doing? And he said, this little fella looked at him, George, real quizzical kind of look, and he just said, when I find it, I'll know it. And he just kept walking. And so his dad was kind of like, wow, that's strange. So the next day, his dad's walking again, and, you know, Ed had gone farther down, but his father was so curious, he stopped him again, and he said, I don't mean to bother you again, but what are you doing? And he just smiled again, and he said, when I find it, I'll know it. And he kept walking. So now this tells me, George, and I get these crazy ideas sometimes. You know, I want to tell people about Coral Castle and thank God for Coast, because nobody else really is tuned into the story or listens. And I had this idea that I would go back to New York and get a coral stone and, you know, walk it down to Miami to see if I could get publicity for this thing, because this is the route that he took. He actually walked all the way from New York to Florida City. And this is when they found him on the side of the road. And this is one of the most intriguing things about the story. You know, everybody gets caught up in, well, how did he move the stones? What did this and that? But the guy was eat up with tuberculosis. And this is all written in the museum there.
Lead Scotland had tuberculosis?
He was eat up with it. Now, this is 1918. There's no cure for it. It's highly contagious. Well, the guy who finds him is riding around in a little old 1918 Ford car. He's a real estate guy. Well, they pass by the road one night and see this guy. Now, there's two versions. Some say it was in the daytime. Some say it was in the night. But Ed was laying on the side of the road, and the real estate man, not knowing he had tuberculosis, of course, picks him up, puts him in his car, drives him home. Well, back in those days, George, in Florida here, everybody had like a Florida porch. You know, it was screened in, and you could sit out there and drink
your coffee. Or you slept out there, too.
Or you slept out there. Keep the mosquitoes off of you. So they pick up this little guy, and they nurse him back to health. And as they're nursing back to health, you know, he's telling them his story. He's from Latvia and Agnes and all these things. And so this is when he starts looking for land down here. But he keeps coughing, you know. So the guy says, well, you know, go to the doctor, man. So the doctor comes and looks at him, and he says, I don't even know how you walked, you know, from the house to here. Your whole body is eaten up with tuberculosis. In those days, George, it got in there, and the fluid would run down into your lungs and drown you almost. Yeah, Ed had to sleep on an angle. And that's why when you go to Coral Castle and you see his bed in there, it's still hung by chains from the ceiling at an angle, because he was trying to keep the fluid out of his lungs to keep from drowning.
Well, I think that's what killed old Doc Holliday, if I remember.
That's right.
Back in the Western days.
That's exactly right. Fluid on the lungs. And so here's this little guy, and he's telling him this story. And so the doctor says, well, you've got 6 months to live. And it didn't seem upset. And so he told his friend, the real estate guy, he said, well, before I go, if I go, I want some land. So he starts going around with his witching rod again, George. And this is so weird because, you know, in one of the Bermuda Triangle things, one of the most important aspects of the triangle is water. You know, there's so much ocean water. Well, Ed said that what he was looking for, he had to find water. Well, when he finds this water in in Florida City, he comes running back to his friend. He says, man, I found the piece of land I want. Let's go look at it. So his friend's in real estate, and he happened to go out there and know the man. And the man looked at Ed, and he said, son, what do you want with this land? You have found the worst land in Florida. Down there, George, you've got 4,000 feet of coral stone. There's only a couple of inches of topsoil, okay, in this one area. And there's scrub pines and bushes, but nothing will grow there. And the old guy looks at him, he said, you know, son, you're going to grow rocks here. That's all you can do. And Ed said, well, sir, I'd love to have the land. And the man said, well, I tell you what, it's no good. I'll give it to you.
He gave it to him?
Just gives it to him. Because he said, I'm your neighbor. I don't want you, you know, having a, you know, house of prostitution next to me or something. But as long as you don't do something too weird, you know. And Ed said, no, I won't. Well, they come back in 3 weeks. And Ed, he tells them, Ed says, just leave me here on my land and take me to a junkyard. I got to make some tools. And they say, to a junkyard? He said, yeah. They take him to the junkyard, George. He picks up all this weird stuff. He gets a bicycle with no tires. You know, all kind of wheels and gears and motors and all this kind of stuff. And
junk. All kinds of junk.
Total
right?
junk, man. I mean, the guy gives it to him. He can't even settle it, so much junk. So Ed parks it on this land out there. Well, 3 weeks later, the real estate guy says, you know, I wonder what that – they started calling him Crazy Ed because after a while, George, he took the bicycle. He was so poor, it had no tires on it, so he just drove it around on the rims.
And what did he do for a living? I mean, how did he earn money?
Well, he didn't earn any money at first. He trapped rabbits, and he grew a little – even though the land was poor, he grew a little garden there on this land they gave him, and he basically just kind of starved to death.
What did he do, sleep in a tent or something?
He slept in the day and worked at night. He had a little tent. And he'd also gotten, from what I understand, a body of an old Model T Ford truck that he parked out there. And he would sleep in that and then put a tent up in the back of it.
All right.
So he's jacked up a little bit off the ground.
Okay.
So he's got his lantern. And so the next 3 weeks later, this real estate guy pulls up there with his wife. Well, here's Ed with his shirt off. Now, he's a little guy, 5 feet, 100 pounds. But they said he was really built, wiry, muscular. And he still got tuberculosis. But here is a 10-ton block of stone hanging from a tripod in the middle. The chain's hanging down the stone, and they're like...
And people are amazed.
And this real estate guy's wife walk out there and go, what are you doing? And they said, how did you get the stone? First of all, they look down, and here's this perfectly cut square, because you imagine, George, trying to cut... If you're in just a flat piece of land, how would you cut that square out, and then how would you get down there and get the rock out of the ground?
Yeah, how do you cut underneath it?
How do you get under it?
Yeah.
But here it is hanging in the hole underneath. And so they ask Ed, well, how did you do it? And he just smiles and he said, well, it's not really that hard once you understand how. And they're like, yeah, well, how did you do it? And he just kind of said, well, he said, I don't care to talk about that. You know, he said, it's easy. Trust me. It's no big deal.
At this point, did he say anything about he knew the secrets of the pyramids?
Didn't say anything.
That didn't come out. Okay.
No. He doesn't really know these people that well yet, so he's already acting weird enough, you know, riding on a bicycle with no tires. He's got tuberculosis. His girlfriend's jilted him, and he's looking for a piece of land, you know, when he's dying. Why does he want to build a house? So all these people are going, what? So anyway, they start trying to sneak up on him at night, George, try to catch him at work. So he's got one wall of the castle up, okay? He's building this castle, but he won't say why. So these farmers have got 3 o'clock in the morning. They're low crawling like alligators out there sneaking their head up. George, the old-timers told me that they said, Joe, you could be 100 yards away from that place. He had an instinct. He would pop up on the wall. He'd look out there, and he'd say, how you doing tonight? He'd say.
And he wouldn't work. He'd stop working?
He'd stop working. He'd start singing, you know. And he said, now, when y'all leave, I'll go back to work. But I can't work as long as you're there. And they're just sitting there freaking out going, how did he? Man, nobody made any noise.
Did he get offended when people came around?
No, he was always... He knew he was in a strange land, and he had to really be cool.
So he was very friendly.
He was very friendly. Nobody ever saw him mad. They never saw him curse. He was always had a great sense of humor, just real witty. And he was just a lovely person, and everybody fell in love with him. And after a while, they just called him Crazy Weird Ed, and they kind of left him alone to, you know, let him do his thing. Well, you remember I told you now, he's got tuberculosis. The doctor says you have 4 to 6 months to live. Well, George, he cuts out a 3-ton circular stone, and he even carves out head pillows on it so he can lay on it, okay?
Yeah.
Mounts it on the wheel bearings of an old Ford truck. He sticks his leg out, and he spins it, okay, like a merry-go-round. He gets in his underwear from 1 o'clock to 3 o'clock every day. As the sun moves in the sky, he puts his foot out and pushes his merry-go-round stone around, and he's catching these rays. Now, some of the old-timers said when they came up on him, they saw him with a pyramid-shaped object, kind of with like a blue stone hanging down. Kind of like that blue light was hitting on his head.
Over him, okay.
Over him, yeah. So he's got a blue light. He never did explain this. 6 months later, he goes back to the doctor. Now, this is all in the museum. The doctor said, I don't believe this. Your lungs are clear as a baby. Your blood is pure. He said, you're like a 15-year-old kid. He said, this is medical history. Nobody, George, that I know of in documented history has ever survived tuberculosis at the terminal stage. So now
he's done that. Has he finished Coral Castle at this point?
No, he's still building it. And about 1936, now he's been working on it for 16 years. And when I say working on it, he keeps adding these, you know, he'll add a wall, and then he'll put, there's 25 one-ton rocking chairs that all balance. They rock on their gravity. They don't have rocker arms. They're on their gravity, okay? So he's almost done. 1,100 tons of coral. Now, this stuff's jagged, too. You can tap it with a hammer, and it will break. But it's also you know, it will cut you to ribbons. Well, these stones, George, are cut so perfectly smooth that you can lay on them. There's beds, there's chairs. So about 1936, and here's another weird thing. I don't know if I told you this last time. He puts up this grid of copper wires above Coral Castle, okay?
Okay.
And everybody's like, what is he doing with a grid of copper wires? And they're thinking, this is World War II now, and they're thinking, oh, my God, he's a spy. He's a Russian spy. So they go and call the police. Well, the police come up there and they say, Ed, you know, we're sorry to bother you. You know, we know you're private, but what is this copper grid you got up here? Are you some kind of spy? Are you getting messages from Germany or what's going on here? So Ed, he was a little embarrassed, George. So he goes around to the back and he shows him this receiver. He had figured out how to put up a copper wire grid. He was receiving free radio stations. He could pick up a radio station. He could pick up Berlin if he wanted to for free.
Well, okay. And if he picked up Berlin, they'd really think he was a spy.
Right. Yeah. Now, some people have said that he used that as a cover, that he actually did do some experiments with it, but as long as he showed them that it was only a radio, that he was cool.
It was magnetics. Had to be.
Had to be. Had to be. So we don't know. One guy was saying, well, if he had that copper grid wire up there, think about it. He was messing with the magnetic ley lines or whatever. Possibly this is how it might have assisted him in moving these stones.
Was it in this region a couple young kids saw him move these blocks?
Yes. And
okay.
Did I tell you that one of the kids was a Bullard? Have I told you that?
No, tell me the story.
Okay. You know, I told you when I first went down there, I met an old man in a gas station. We were talking. He pulled up. It was a 1930s gas station. It was all closed up. And I'm just looking in there. And so an old car pulls up, and he introduces himself. And he said, what are you doing down here?
And in those days, Joseph, they were called filling stations.
Filling station. Thank you. Yeah. And which I loved it, Georgia. There was an old green leather chair in there and books that you could see that had been sitting there for 30, 40 years with dust on them. And so I told him, I said, well, I'm researching a story on Coral Castle, and I said, I'm down here to find people who might have known Ed. This guy was like 87, 88, 89. And he said, well, son, he said, would you like to meet somebody that sold him eggs, sardines, and crackers, his favorite food? And I said, oh, I'd love to. And he said,
absolutely.
Well, you're talking to him. And I said, you? And he stuck his hand out, and he said, I am J.T. Bullard. And I said, you got to be kidding me. And I stuck my hand out, and I said, I'm Joe Bullard. And he was like, he thought I was lying. So after a few minutes of Irish talk, you know, we go in the gas station. He sits down 3 or 4 hours. This is where I got most of my information on kind of the private side of it. He didn't talk to too many people, but Mr. Buller got close to him. And so one of the children, you know, the last time you were asking me, you know, can you find any of those kids who were there?
Right. They're not kids anymore. But
right. They're dead now. But anyway, a lady, a truck driver who's a real big Toast fan, emailed me. And she said, my name's Sharon Bullard. Maybe she's listening tonight. She said, my father was one of the children who saw Ed float the stones.
Oh, my.
Okay? And, George, I was making a joke because when you go down to Coral Castle, he took bumpers off of a car, and he took them to the shoemaker. And he said, I'm tired of wearing out these leather brogans on this coral. It's cutting my shoes up. Can you make me some steel soles? And the guy was like, are you kidding me? Ed was known as a penny pincher kind of. So he came back 2 weeks later, George, and this guy's made him these bumper soles for his shoes.
He wanted them for a reason.
And so as I was telling you the story, well, somebody emailed me, and the girl said, well, Mr. Bullard, the boy who saw him floating, said Ed told the children. He always told children stories, George, because he knew nobody would believe him. And he told the children the real reason that he had the steel and shoes was to keep him from floating away from there when he was working at night.
That may be true. I think Ed somehow understood anti-gravity through magnetics somehow.
There's no doubt.
I've got a book of his that I carry around with me about his magnetics, and he understood that objects, could be wood, could be anything, had the ability to be magnetized.
Correct.
Or not.
Right.
Okay, so he finishes this facility here. What happens? He gets into a fight. Does he get jumped? And he decides, I'm moving. What happens?
He's in his castle one night, okay? He's doing his research. And, you know, you can't really sneak up on Ed because he's got this sixth sense.
Right.
And I think he was so involved in his work that he didn't catch what was happening because these thugs, you know, he didn't really have a locked door. Everything was pretty much open. You could come in the back way through the nine-ton spinning gate. And these about six hoods came in, and they started asking him all these questions like, you know, what is this stuff you're doing here? Where's your magnetic machine? Why are you doing this? And then another guy said, oh, don't bother him about that. We want his money. So there was two or three different stories. Well, they just beat the heck out of him, George, almost kill him. Like I said, he's a little guy, six of them. They almost, in fact, I think they think that they had killed him. They leave him there. Well, his real estate friend just happens to go there the next day and finds him, takes him to the hospital, and they revive him, okay? Right after this, now he's got the coral castle almost finished, 1,100 tons of coral. He's only got a few things left he wants to do. All of a sudden, he calls up a friend of his who had a special truck for hauling timber. There's timber down there in those days, Georgia. My dad is in the cypress business, and there was huge logs that they used to carry on trucks. So they had extra suspension, and Ed knew one of them, and he called him, and he said, look, I need some help in the morning. Meet me there at 7:30 at the castle. So the guy shows up, and he says, what are we going to do? And Ed points to the castle, and he said, we're going to move these stones one by one down Key West Highway. He's in Florida City now, which is 10 miles south of Homestead. He said, we're going to move these stones one at a time all the way to Homestead. And the guy was like, huh? So Ed says, look, back the trailer up here to that 30-ton stone and give me an hour. So the guy says, okay, backs it up. The guy comes back in an hour, and there's three stones loaded on this truck.
All ready
to
go.
Always ask me, how in the world did that truck carry those stones? Well, it was already weighted for those big logs, so that was no problem, and Ed knew it. Ed knew how to calculate exactly how many stones would fit on the truck.
And this was coral, which wasn't as heavy as pure rock, right?
Right.
Okay.
Right, because it's porous. You know,
he decides, I'm out of here, I'm going to Homestead.
Right. Now, many people have said, and Ed always have a cover story, George. He would never tell you. It wasn't that he would lie, but when you ask him why he's moving, he said, well, I hear there's a subdivision coming in here, and, you know, I like my privacy, so I'm moving it because of the subdivision. Now, there are people who believe in these ley lines, like we've talked about, these energy lines that run across the earth. And believe it or not, as we were talking about Bermuda Triangle, that Bermuda Triangle, I was looking at it tonight, and I was showing my wife. If you look at the tip of the Bermuda Triangle now, not the Devil's Triangle, George, it comes right through where Coral Castle is, and the tip of the point goes out the other side of Florida, right through the Everglades.
Yep.
So he
knew where he was going.
He knew where he was going. And he figured that, and this is another thing that's interesting, these ley lines can be interrupted by earthquakes. If you have an earthquake or a crack in the earth, it'll shake the earth, and these energy lines can be messed up. And they figure that something happened, that he made a surveying error in Florida City, and the power was stronger at Homestead, so he wants to move to Homestead to get to where the power is.
All right, Joe, when we come back, we'll talk about what happened at Homestead and how he set things up and get more of your theories. And as you know, several years ago, Richard C. Hoagland went out to Coral Castle, did some measurements, and came up with some incredible electronic readings. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. We're with Joe Bullard, the author of the book Waiting for Agnes. WaitingForAgnes.com is his website, linked up at CoastToCoastAM.com. Joe, is the book still available, sir?
Yes, sir, it is. It's in the second printing now, thanks to you.
Excellent. Well, maybe it'll go into 3 and 4. Okay, so Ed Lead Skolnin is now on to Homestead, Florida. Tell us what's he doing. He's putting this back together again.
He's putting this place back together, George. Here again, another interesting thing. One of the truck driver that's working with him, if I remember the last time we were talking there, he tells the truck driver to go around and wait for him for an hour. Well, one day, the truck driver tried to sneak around and see what Ed was doing, and Ed caught him. And so he was embarrassed, and so he stayed where he was supposed to. Well, one day he actually forgot his lunch pail on the truck. And so he thought, he really wasn't thinking. He didn't think about Ed catching him. He just walked back in there to get his lunch pail. This was like 30 minutes later when he got hungry. There was nobody around, and the stones were already loaded.
Already loaded and ready to go. Now, was it in this area that the Lead Skolnin had kept waiting for Agnes to show up?
Yes. Now, here's an interesting thing, and I don't think I mentioned this so much last time. We have so much ground to cover. When he was first doing the castle, he builds it in Florida City. He tells everybody that comes on the tour, he would give a tour. Excuse me. And one sure. Interesting thing, George, I hadn't mentioned before, I don't think. As you go into the Coral Castle, you walk through a steel door, and with this weird, the way the sun revolves around the earth, and or the Earth revolves around the sun. I'm sorry. And you walk through there. There's a three like a triangle gate. Okay, it weighs 3 tons. The way Ed started this off was he would tell everybody, you know, folks, I really want to give you a tour today, but this 3-ton stone is blocking us. Is there anybody strong enough to push this stone so we can get through and go see the castle? And of course, everybody said no. He picks out this little girl, and he said, honey, come up here and you do this. And she said, no, I'm too little. I can't even push a lawnmower, much less a 3-ton stone. So he asked her, he said, look, push it with all your might, and it's going to work. So she gets up there, George, and everybody's waiting, like, how can she do it? And because they've never been in the Coral Castle. So right. As she goes to push it, she stumbles because it spins so easily. Okay?
Yeah.
And I'm going to come back to something here that I had not seen in all the 30 years I've been studying it. Underneath this triangular stone is a tunnel, like a box. If he cut a square under there, like a periscope kind of, that goes all the way through on the side of the stone, okay, and as this stone spins. Now, if you go to the castle today, that square is down there, but I had never seen it. So as he finishes up the castle and he moves it from Florida City to Homestead, he changes the story. He doesn't talk about Agnes anymore. Only little bits to his friends. So one day, because he used to tell everybody on the tour what happened. So one day his friend says, Ed, I've noticed since you moved from Florida City to Homestead, you don't talk about Agnes anymore. What happened? Are you not waiting for her anymore? And he said, well, yeah. He said, I'm waiting on her. He said, but, you know, I just left her in Florida City. And the guy said, you left her in Florida City? And he said, yeah, I just decided to leave her there.
He lied about it.
Yeah. What he was saying was, I'm moving on. I'm still waiting for her, I'm still hoping, but with the new move.
Ah, I see what you mean. Okay.
Yeah, I'm moving on now.
And did he? You think he did?
In a way, yeah. Yeah. By then, everybody was used to the story, and when the tourists would come down, everybody would say, oh, you got to come see Coral Castle. And as Ed was giving the tour, if he wouldn't talk about Agnes, they'd say, Ed, tell him about Agnes. So they'd kind of force him into it, and then he'd go back. So then he realized that it was just a part of the story, and he might as well tell it because people loved it. So he kept the story alive, but he really had made up his mind to leave her in Florida City.
Joe, was he more of a legend when he was alive or dead?
Dead.
Okay.
Dead, because people, George, just like the Bermuda Triangle, they got used to him. You go to the Coral Castle, you see it. And I've heard people down there today, George, when I go down, you know, I'll be standing there and somebody will say, well, I don't see the big deal. It's just a bunch of rocks. And I'm standing there going,
They don't understand. A little skinny 100-pound man moved all those rocks.
Exactly. And, George, the Polaris telescope, I have to tell you this because maybe I mentioned it last time and I don't remember if I did or not. But on the Polaris telescope, there is there's a front eyesight, and it's made in a pyramid form, and it sits on the north wall. The telescope goes out 25 yards, and it's a square box, and it comes up, and it has a round hole diagonally cut in it, about the size of a coffee can. It has a crosshairs in it of wire and a crosshair at the front. So as you're looking through it, it looks like a telescope or of a rifle. The pyramid eyepiece matches the piece 25 yards out in the distance. Does that make sense?
Yes.
When you look through it, now there's a guy down there. His name is Ray Ramirez. Last time I was down there, he said, Joe, I was checking my figures, and last year he said during the winter solstice, the sun actually appears in the sight of the Polaris telescope.
He understood celestial mechanics. He understood, I think, anti-gravity. The question is, who taught him, Joe?
Oh, God, George, I wish I could know that. Everybody asked me, well, did he, you know, if you ask Ed to that, here's another thing about his personality. When he first got there, George, he would spend 5 hours. There's a little library there in Florida City. I mean, like, it used to be like 10 by 15. I'm sure it's bigger than that. Very tiny. But the guy would spend 5 hours a day. And everybody would say, he's reading these books. And if you ask him how he knew what he would know, he would say, well, you have to read books on Egypt, magnetism. He would explain all these books, and they say, well, where do you get them? And he would just smile, and he'd say, well, I can't tell you where you get them. You just get them. And he said, if you want to know what I know, read the books I read. Okay? I have to believe, George, that he came here with this knowledge from Latvia. I think
so, too. Now, the tripod that everybody sees, in pictures, and that was out there at Coral Castle, mm-hmm. might have been used to help move and position these rocks, right. you know, and get them in place. But they surely weren't the things that allowed him to cut them and move them and everything else. When he died, Joe, there was a search of the area. Wasn't there some kind of apparatus, some kind of a flywheel machine that people found?
Yeah. Now, the perpetual, that's called a perpetual motion holder, and that's still there, George, and the plans to build it are still there.
Okay, but it's in pieces or something,
isn't
it?
It's in pieces, but things have been robbed away from it, but you can still sit there with the handle, okay? It's got horseshoe-shaped magnets inside with copper wire around it. It's like the size of a washtub, George.
Okay.
There's a handle on top of it, an old iron handle, and you turn it.
You crank it.
You crank it, right. And Ed said, when you get these magnets spinning, the north and the south pole chasing each other, until you interrupt the current, and he had a little copper wire. When he wanted to interrupt the current, he just stuck the wire down there, interrupted the current, and broke it. And he said, this is what people don't understand. The whole universe, what gravity is magnets, north and south pole magnets chasing each other. And once they start, he said, you can take this machine, and he used to write this in his books. He said, all the scientists should come down here to Florida and see what I've built and what I've done. And he said, you can take my machine, put it in the head of a rocket. This was when the rockets were just starting. He died in 1951. And he said, take my machine, put it in your rockets. You can fly out to Pluto in the morning for breakfast, go all the galaxy, anywhere you want to go, come back to Earth, and you're going to have the same amount of energy as when you left.
I wonder if we have this kind of propulsion system now. We might.
We do. We do. We have all of it.
This flywheel, did it move? I mean, was it mobile or did it stay in a room?
It's stationary. It's in his tool room.
How far away was the tool room from where all the blocks were placed? Right there, or was it off a ways?
In other words, if you were to go into the Coral Castle and you go into, let's see, the north, it would be on the east wall where the sun is. That's where his home and his tool room was. And Coral Castle's probably 40, 50 yards wide, something like that. So he would have had it stationed right there where he could have moved anything he wanted to right around in that area.
I wonder what the range was, assuming this worked as anti-gravity. I wonder what the range was for it once he got it going.
Well, you know, I think one of the best theories, and this was from Christopher Dunn, when we talked, he was on your show, and then he called me and we talked, and, you know, he mm-hmm. said, and it's weird, I looked under the machine, I hadn't noticed until Chris mentioned it, but if you look under the machine, George, there is a coupling there where an iron wire would fit in, and you could tighten the bolts on it. Take that wire out, Chris Dunn said. Go out there, circle the stone with that wire, then crank your machine up, and what you're doing is that's your anti-gravity machine. It pushes up, and, you know, at the same time, it defies gravity.
Joe, do you know if anybody in government took an active role to come down to Coral Castle to investigate Leeds Scullin, to interview people, to ask them questions? Anybody?
George, I've got an update on that for you. You know, we spoke 4 years ago, and I met with Jeb Bush. The minute I mentioned for him to come down and give a tour, I said, Jeb, nobody has officially. He said, well, I was there. And I said, but you weren't governor at the time, were you? You were a tourist. And he said, right. And I said, how can you let this go? How can you not be the governor and go back down? And let's have an Ed's Day. Let's have a parade every day. Let's move those stones, you know, just make styrofoam ones and go 10 miles and let everybody know about this place. We want to attract tourists. Why don't we tell them? George, the minute I said that, he said, the interview's over. You know, thank you, Mr. Buller, blah, blah, blah. Now, enter Charlie Crist, okay?
Right.
I called his office. I think his information officer is named Eric Isaac. You can never speak to these guys, but I spoke to the secretary and told him what I was doing. I said, look, I met with Jeb Bush, gave him a book. You know, he was real nice, put the book in the, you know, in the governor's mansion library. But I said, he was saying that maybe the next governor might want to recognize Coral Castle. I told him the whole story. George, this has been 2 months ago. I've never heard an answer, never a word, not a peep. No mayor, no governor, no senator, nobody will go down and recognize Coral Castle.
Somebody has had to have done it on an unofficial basis.
Unofficially? Well, see, Jeb Bush was there unofficially, but he wouldn't go officially.
Yeah, but, I mean, he didn't do research. somebody has researched Lead Skull Nin.
Oh, for sure. Yes, yes.
You know what? They've tried to reassemble the flywheel, or they've created it.
I'm sorry. You're absolutely. Well, and when he was beaten up, we cut to break by the time he was getting beat up. There were guys down there who said, and this is true. I know this is true. The government sent three agents in there three different times, because remember, this was World War II, and I don't know if the Philadelphia experiment was real or not, but if they could have gotten a hold of Ed's machine and put these things in planes, like he said, and flown around or whatever, they wanted this information, but he refused to give it to them. The third time they visited him, and he refused them, he got beat up.
I wonder if Lead Skullman ever met a Nikola Tesla.
In my records, I can find nothing.
Oh, my gosh. What a meeting that would have been.
And Tesla died, I believe, George, in 45.
Yeah, and Ed was around.
And Ed was still here. He died in 51.
Right.
And Tesla, like you say, now Tesla actually took Ed's machine, and, you know, he had the car, like we've talked about, going 90 miles an hour. Remember the battery charged? Well, it wasn't battery.
Yeah.
Remember? 90 miles an hour.
So let me get this right. Lead Skullman puts together this entire facility, stays there how long? Does he ever work? And then he dies there?
Oh, yeah. Well, when you say when he never worked, he trapped rabbits, he grew a garden, and someone said that he had a little bit of stock in electric utilities that I haven't been able to prove that yet, but that he got a little income from that. But see, George, there were no taxes in those days. He dug a well. Now, I still don't know how he did this. 6 feet down into that coral with steps, okay? And you go down there, and he kept his food in there in jars, and he had his water. He just had his machine for electricity. He had no taxes. And so basically, he didn't – you know, when he died, George, he left 38 $100 bills stuffed down a pipe, okay? And attached to that pipe was what people called a treasure map. Some people said it did not relate to anything – that we understand as far as longitude and latitudes. I still don't understand that, but they said they tried to follow it. They thought it was a treasure map, and they finally got disgusted. And the last I heard was a police detective took the map home, and it was either stolen or lost or burned or something, and it's never been found again.
Where's he buried?
Pardon me?
Where's he buried?
Ed, he's buried, believe it or not, in Miami. He wanted to be buried in Coral Castle, and there was some kind of mix-up in – I hope before I die one day I can dig him up and take him to Coral Castle.
Well, that would be nice. It's a remarkable facility. Does it have a roof or is it open?
It's all open.
Okay, so where did he, I mean, when he slept there?
Now the whole Coral Castle is open, but now his quarters, it's about, George, it's probably 10 by 12, and it's two-story. In the bottom of it is his tool room. And up above that was his living quarters.
Okay, and I mean, very small.
Yeah, and the weird thing, George, he goes and gets these running boards. You remember the old 1920s and 30s trucks and cars had the running boards?
Right.
He took these running boards and buried them in the coral walls there somehow, end to end, like corner boards. And he would crawl up the walls there and put his food in jars and stuff. So that was how he stored it. Then, of course, he had his bed hanging from the chains. And then he had his... You know, he had a food safe there that was hanging from the wall straight down so that no bugs could get into it.
And when he died, quiet death, huh?
He knew he was dying. He just had a premonition. He wrote a card on the castle, and he said, "I'm going to the hospital." And he got his bicycle, rode it over to the bus station, climbed on a bus, got into Miami, checked into Jackson Memorial Hospital. I think he kind of fainted right there in the check-in, in the registration. And they said, "God, this guy's mal-." They find out he had cancer of the stomach. He had not been eating. I think he was ready to go. He was tired. He was 64 years old. And he rallied for a while. They fed him, and he actually came to around the second day. Then he went back into the coma, and on the third day, he was gone.
Gosh.
No family. He left the castle to a friend or a nephew. The only relative he had here was, his name was Harry Lead Skullman in Chicago. And Harry was very sick. He didn't even have time. He never went to Coral Castle. And he sold it to a couple in Chicago. 2 years later, he died.
Do they still own it?
They still own it.
Yeah. And they charge, what's the admission to get into Coral Castle?
It's gone up quite a bit. It used to be $6 when I was there. It's about $10 to go through it now.
How many people go through that?
It used to be about 75,000 until Coase picked it up. Now it's probably 125, 130.
1,000 people a year?
Yeah. And it grows every year. Every time we do a show, it's like, oh, my God, you know.
Is there a staff down there?
Yeah, yeah. They have a manager and a staff. You know, like we talked about last time, every time I go down there, I'm a little sadder because, you know, the tools are rustier. The door, the front door where you have this, I don't know how he etched it into this door, George. It looks like a laser etching with the, I keep getting it mixed up, but it's the earth going around the sun. It's like a planetary thing. And he used to say, if the scientists would come down and look at my drawing, he said the books are wrong about how the earth revolves around the sun. Come down, look at my stone telescope and this door, and you'll see the difference.
Jeez. I would have loved to have interviewed him.
Oh, my God.
I wonder if he would have revealed his secrets on the show.
No.
You don't think so?
No, sir, because...
I could have squeezed it out of him.
You might have got it out of him. I could have never... You might have twisted him, but what happened...
Come on, Ed, it's a secret of the world. Let us know.
You know, George, he was brought up in Latvia, and the people that I've talked to there, I said, why didn't he reveal it? And they said, look, man, we work like dogs over here. If you want to learn something, you do the same kind of work. We're not giving you anything. He was brought up in that austere fashion, and every time he would say, and the key to knowing why he didn't release information is, you want to know what I know, do the work, because he said knowledge without work is dangerous. So if I tell you how he would have revealed it to you, George, if he'd gone in there and said, okay, Ed, show me this, show me that, I'm ready to do the work. Put on he used to wear alligator gloves,
yep,
you know, to keep the thing from cutting. If you'd gone in there and shown him that you would work, because the kids told me, Sharon Buller told me that her father said that they used to see him a lot of times walking around there doing stuff, and he didn't mind as long as the kids were there, and sometimes he would even work with the older children there. But the minute the adults came into view, boom, everything was put away.
Jeez. I got to tell you, he was a remarkable man, and I can't believe this hour's already gone by as well, Joe. We're going to take phone calls with you next, Joe Bullard, Bermuda Triangle, Coral Castle. You're next on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back. Joe Bullard, our special guest, and of course we're going to take your phone calls as well. Bermuda Triangle, Coral Castle. Both subjects, Joe, are fantastic. Do you have one over the other?
Oh, Coral Castle.
That's your baby, isn't
it? That's my sweetheart, my sweet 16.
If you met Ed Leedskalnin, what would you ask him?
What would I ask Ed?
He gives you a moment to ask him one question.
One question. I would say, Ed, would you tell me anything?
And he'll say, well, sure, it's nice outside. And there goes your question.
Because if you directly ask him, you're out the window. You can only say, teach me something or, you know.
You know what I would ask him? I would not ask him anything about what he does. I'd trick him. I'd go, Ed, how do you think the Egyptians built the pyramids?
Oh, Mike, that's dirty. That's dirty, George.
He might fall for that. He'd say, well, let me tell you.
Because then he's got to prove to you that he knows it, right?
Exactly.
Go for his ego.
Exactly. Yep.
That's you might get him on that now. I got to give you credit on that one.
All right, let's take some calls. You ready?
Yeah.
Wild card line, you're on the air. Buzz, I guess, you're on the air.
Hey, this is Buzz from Imaginative Worlds Forum. Good evening, gentlemen.
Thank you, sir.
I work image code, which is like the Divine Grid, Da Vinci code, that sort of thing. And once you work that and use the Path Going 9 code, and you work Atlantis and you work Ed, I love Ed. I mean, Coast to Coast Radio turned me on to Ed about 6 years ago in my 7 years research. And he's a riddle freak, but you have to know code to work him. And I want to start off real quick with the Bermuda Triangle. In my research, image research, I think, and I'm asking you, sir, if you've ever researched or dealt with the Yggdrasil, I think that there is some type of a mechanical device that resembles the Tree of Life, the Yggdrasil. And I've matched the imagery from the Himalayas to Peru to Europe. But it comes to a certain latitude, right off of between Brazil, if you cross from Florida to Brazil, out in the ocean, like the Fountain of Youth. I found it. I'm not going to give it up. It'll take me an hour to explain it. But if Hitler was working this, now all of a sudden you've got Ed coming in from Latvia. And I think Ed kind of got stranded here. I think he was from another dimension. And I can tell just what you got just saying tonight earlier, your stories have been great. I always questioned, did Ed really die, or did he fake his death? I don't know.
God, how old would that make him now, Joe? But I guess age doesn't matter if you've got this kind of ability.
Yeah, it would be the, you know, end of, you know, there wouldn't be any time. You're right.
Hey, Buzz, what's the one thing that fascinates you about the Leeds Cullinan story?
Me? Are you asking
yeah.
me, sir?
Yeah.
Well, Ed talked in riddle, and he had a. He, if you don't know how to read his wording, and you're using the Pascal 9 code, there's a numeric that comes out to it. And then this John DePue, who claims that he's discovered Ed. Well, there's an in-between gap that I've been working. In fact, I've been working longer than Hoagland. And it does, I hate to use the word, hyperdimensional, but there is a geophysic frequency that goes with the hyperdimensional part. If you look back at Hurricane Ophelia, and there was this mechanical-looking turning device manipulating the hurricane, it all correlates with a certain part of the Atlantic Ocean off the East Coast. And I've written bits on it, but I don't want to give. I don't know what to say because I don't know if I'm going to get knocks on my door. But well, I trust me, I've already had one, and it's not a good time. In fact, George and I talked about this about 3 or 4 years ago, but I won't get into that. There is something there that is. I know this sounds crazy, but it might even be. Mechanical, invisible, but I think it has to do with hyperdimensional and geophysic frequency. And it makes sense. And I personally, I think the Bermuda Triangle is far bigger than it really is, as they claim it is. But everything correlates with a certain longitude, latitude off of Florida, if you correlate it to the northern part of Brazil, Venezuela, and Peru. So, yeah, I'm sitting here rambling. But I'm so excited to talk about this because I've worked at it. And his main thing is the pressure cooker, the hanging device that he has. Ed was giving us things that weren't to be figured out until a later time when we really need it. And this guy's a hero. He was showing us how to read Vulcan activity, earthquakes and volcanoes.
Well, he was quite the guy. Hey, say hi to everybody at the Imaginative Worlds for me, Buzz.
Hey, thanks. You know what? Thank you very much. You know, my computer got hacked. I had an Apple, and I took it to some experts, and they said, Buzz, whoever got you, they got you. So I've been offline since about December.
Oh, that's frustrating.
But, yeah, when I go to Nevada and I get on my girlfriend's computer, then I get to check in real quick. But you know what? You guys, Coast to Coast, and people like your host tonight or your guest, I've been working this code for 7 years now. It changed my life.
Well, let's get your take on this, Joe. And thanks, Buzz.
Thank
Appreciate
you very
being
much.
On the
Thank you.
You're welcome. Go ahead,
George. I think he's he's way above where I'm at on this. I think he's got something there. It's deep. You know, I'd really have to. I was just catching bits and pieces of it here, and I'd really, before I made a comment on that, I'd have to sit down and kind of study what he's doing there. But when it comes to Ed, George, there's just nothing that's not possible.
Nothing would surprise you.
Nothing. Nothing at all.
So he could have done a code.
There's no doubt about it, because when you're talking about code, and I'll just try to slip this in here real quick, I don't know if we've talked about it before, but are you familiar with the sarcophagus in the Great Pyramid, you know, it doesn't have a lid.
Yeah.
And if you convert the inches to miles, you know, it's dimensions, it gives you the distance of the earth to the sun, earth to the moon to the earth, that kind
of
thing.
I think that's the one that Art might have jumped in when he was down there.
Okay. Well, if you go to Coral Castle, on the north wall is the 30-ton stone. Now, that was the heaviest stone, okay? And that is the stone that Ed said, you know, he put his crowning achievement on. And you notice the inverted stone on top of two little stones. And I was looking in my research, that configuration of stones, the little inverted stone on top, is in the north wall of the Great Pyramid there where the sarcophagus, it's looking down on the sarcophagus exactly, okay? Now, on the back of this 30-ton wall where Ed said his largest stone was, there's a curvature back there, George, and Ed used to tell people, you have to go around the back of the castle. You don't notice it on the tour. He never gave it on the tour, but some kids would go around the back, and they'd say, well, what is this curvature here? And he'd always laugh, and he'd say, well, it's a bird bath. Well, it's a heck of a bird bath because it's a circle, and then it has a hole drilled right through the middle of the circle. And if you take these dimensions, and I'm getting this from, I wish you could get a hold of Ray Stoner one time, and because he's so deep, I can't follow half of it. But Ray Stoner broke this down, and that circle back there and the hole, one side, it's a cube, okay? And it's it talks about the mean density of the Earth is 5.6, the Earth's true diameter. It's the same thing as the sarcophagus in the Great Pyramid, George, and it's telling us about, okay, on the radius of the circle back there, the Earth's moon has a 28-day period, and talks about Neptune is so many miles, and all of these numbers are encoded in that circle that Ed laughed and said was a bird bath.
Okay, let's go next to our West of the Rockies line. You're on Coast to Coast. Welcome to the program. Hi there.
Hi, this is Don in Salem, Oregon.
Hey, Don, go ahead.
Hi, George and Joe. Fascinating. Joe, if you think you're behind the curve, I'm really behind the curve. Happy days. I had seen the Discovery Channel thing with the caretaker of the Coral Castle. Excuse me.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And this guy was very interesting, but he kind of led you around the Coral Castle, and he could tell he was holding back, quite a bit. But Joe, what I wanted to ask is, have you ever seen the underground gardens in Fresno, California?
No, sir, I've never seen them.
Oh, fascinating, because I think this guy was on kind of the same lines, not to the degree that Ed was, but back when I was a kid, maybe 14 or 15, they took you down in these underground gardens, and this guy had been grafting fruit trees together, like grapefruits with oranges and limes and lemons. So this guy had to know something about that stuff, too, to a certain degree. And
what was he doing underground with all this?
Well, in Fresno, when it gets hot in the summer, he found it easier to grow grapes and these kind of trees. And it's not just a small place. This thing goes on for acres.
Underground, what did he do for sunlight?
That's what I'm thinking.
Well, he had holes in the ground and reflecting. Oh, I would say mirrors or something like this. He probably did this back in the 30s or the 40s.
Wow.
But would allow the sunlight to come in and, grow these trees. He had living quarters. He had dining quarters. It just absolutely astounding. So, Joe, if you could check up on that, you might be interested on how he did that along with Ed in Florida.
I would love
that. That's a great story. Thanks. I'd love to go see this spot.
Me too.
Next up, let's go east of the Rockies. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hello?
Yep, go ahead.
Oh, this is Bob from White Springs.
Okay, Bob, thank you.
Yeah, I had two thoughts. One, I wanted to talk about the Bermuda Triangle, and it just occurred to me that maybe the people and the planes or the ships that have gotten lost, maybe it wasn't so much that they were abducted or anything. Maybe they were just roadkill in the atmospheric backwash as these ships go back and forth. And maybe we're just so insignificant to these beings of such higher intelligence that, well, we're essentially roadkill.
George, you want to handle that?
You know what? Anything could be going on in this vast universe. Anything. And any theory is always acceptable on this program. Thanks, Bob. Appreciate you being on the program. Next up, let's go to our wild card line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hey, what's up?
Hey.
I'd like to talk about my time when I was in the United States Navy.
Okay.
I was on the USS Nicholson going through the Bermuda Triangle area. I'm not sure of the exact location, but I do recall seeing just plain glassy ocean, not a wave in sight, not even a small surge. And it was very difficult to, discern where's the horizon. You couldn't see it at all. I'd always hoped that I would see something really weird, but then I got to thinking, wait, I see something really weird that probably means I'm not going to be coming back home. So.
You won't be able to call this program.
Right. So, I have seen that on a number of the ships that I was stationed on. And, George, I appreciate your time with you being in the Navy. And
thank you.
And I've done my 20, and I am done with it. And I'm just hoping that other people out there on the ocean take care of themselves, and if they see any weird, strange things, and give you guys a call.
Great. Hey, are you getting that 20-year check yet, that start?
Oh, I've been getting it for the past year and a half.
Good, good. Everything helps, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. I did 6 extra days just to make sure I got my retirement.
Okay. All right. Where are you calling from?
St. Louis.
Oh, that's not too far away. Boy, did it pour out today.
Yes, it did, and it was great driving through it because there's a bunch of idiots on the road who don't understand the concept of hydroplaning.
You got that right. You got that. Okay, thanks for the call.
Sure.
You know, he's right. I mean, if you go through the Bermuda Triangle, if you go through one of these mists, chances are, Joseph, you might not be coming back.
For sure. You know, I'm sitting here thinking about, and we didn't get a chance. There's so much in that Bermuda Triangle, George, but one guy was towing a barge, and all of a sudden that electronic fog circled and encompassed the barge. And I think he was hauling coal or something.
Why do you call it the electronic mist?
Well, they call it the electronic fog, and this was Bruce Gernon, actually. I mean, I don't know that he started it, but he said electronic fog because it fogs up all your electronics. Nothing works. So that's just a term that they came up with because compasses go crazy, gyros. And, George, even the new planes that have got these, you know, I forget what you call it, but you put it on the plane, and when it's lost, you can go to it, the sounders or the whatever.
The GPS?
Yeah, I'm sorry, the GPS, thank you. Those don't even work. When the plane gets lost, it's gone, even with the GPS.
All right, there's something going on. There's something magnetic or electrical, and it's affecting all this. Now, the question is it paranormal, supernatural, you know, or is it, you know, part of this planet?
I think it's a combination.
Yeah, I still like the theory of a portal into a parallel universe.
I think that makes the most sense because that's, you know, you look up and these people that saw this plane on the Queen Elizabeth, it comes down, it crashes. One person said they saw the sky open up and the plane just went through it. So that's a portal, and those are eyewitnesses.
Let's go to our first-time caller line. Hi, Chuck. Go ahead, please.
Hi, George. Thanks for taking my call. I'm listening to you on XM, but when I'm not on the road, I am AM to PM.
Ah, yes. Another St. Louisan.
I've long held a theory on the Bermuda Triangle, and I'd like to hear Joe's opinion on it. You have to assume there's some the evidence, the reports we've gotten, that there's some type of time warp that takes place in the area. For whatever, if it's a natural reason, maybe a natural meeting of the energy vortexes of the Earth or whatever. The reports say from the 1945 pilot that said they looked like UFOs or they looked like aliens. If a flight of B-1B, the stealth bombers from today, happened to be flying through there and underwent a time shift, and he were to see something like a B-1B or maybe something even further in the future that shifted back to hit to a pilot in 1945, that would look like alien spacecraft. It would be so out of his realm
absolutely.
Of recognition.
Yep.
And then if you look at situations like, you know, you have a lot of reports from history, the Incas and the Egyptians and spacecraft coming down from the sky. And, you know, a lot of people talk about UFOs. But if spacecraft from today, if an airplane from today were to undergo a time warp and end up back like birds saw mammoths, reports see mammoths and ancient creatures, say they were transported back into an ancient era, such as the time of the Incas, and crash-landed, you know, sure, they come from a time with electricity and telephones, but with the, you know, if you or I were to go back into that time frame, how could we explain any of that? You know, the most we could do is maybe make some effects on civilization at that point, like these creatures supposedly did, and so maybe that explains a lot of these spacecraft or whatever that came back. Maybe it's actually planes that underwent a time warp and ended up landing in that era.
Gosh.
You sound more enthralled with some of the callers, Joe, than some of the older, real, original stories.
Yeah, I'm just, you know, I'm thinking, you know, I'm a baby boomer, so I love the Twilight Zone, and I'm just, all these ideas and stuff, they just fit exactly the research that I've been doing and the books that I've been reading. Caller here, you're just right on top of it.
Well, let me tell you, Joe, the Bermuda Triangle is one of those areas. That, the Philadelphia Experiment, so many people are fascinated by these mysteries. I got to tell you, I was on a cruise once in the Bermuda Triangle, and you do feel kind of eerie when you know you're in this triangle.
Yeah.
It's a weird feeling. You ever, you know, you've been down in that region, but have you ever had a close call yourself?
Nothing. I've been through there, I don't know how many times. My wife is actually from Honduras, so we have to fly through there. And I've never had anything. I've fished in there, taken cruises, and I finally just kept thinking, God, I wish something would happen. And it never does.
All right, Joe, we'll be back and take final calls. And welcome back. We're with Joe Bullard. We're going to take the final phone calls for you here. Explain the theory again of the Bermuda Triangle as the possible portal for the Galactic Magnetic Highway, Joseph.
George, what they're talking about here is, and I thought about this, as like Route 66, you know, the old highway from Chicago out to Los Angeles. This seems to be something where these magnetic forces come in, and they're talking about, I'm not exactly sure, George, if I catch this totally, but, you know, you're talking about the other side of, like, the portal, and what would you find when you get in there. But there seems like the galaxy, it's got, like, a magnetic opposite, and that, say, like, the Highway Route 66 might be compared to my I-75, and we might be in the same general zone there, and yet we're blocked by this electronic fog or this time warp or this zone, and yet if we could somehow reach that that highway over there, we would be traveling it. And the fellow that called the several earlier ones that said, you know, this could be we could be backwashed. That's exactly what some of the people that I've read written. They said that these ions could be coming off of the ships, the UFOs that fly in the atmosphere, and that actually like a wave or a big wave comes and hits these things. And I'm sure the UFOs know that they're there, but they're busy traveling, and it's kind of like he said, we're kind of like roadkill. So I was really shocked to hear him use that analogy. So,
okay, let's move on. Let's take some calls. Let's go to our wild card line. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi. This is Carl from Milwaukee. When I heard your guest Joe talk about that Ed had studied a lot of books on ancient Egypt, one of the things that popped into my mind was a starting point with the architect Imhotep. He was the architect for the Pharaoh Zoster, right. But he was also renowned as a great healer, a medicine man. And you know, when I heard about his tuberculosis being healed, you know, I'm just wondering, this one person started something, and I don't know, Joe, if you actually looked into that thought about that idea.
No, sir, not really. I've heard that theory kind of on, you know, the books and stuff that he read, but I'm not really up on that.
Yeah, he's in fact, he was called actually the true father of modern medicine because they revered him as a god. But the Step pyramid that's also built, which is the very first pyramid, I mean, the stones had to be moved somehow.
That's a good point. That's true.
So that could be a starting point. And maybe Imhotep passed it on to the next vizier and architect and so forth.
And you know what's funny to me is, you know, we're almost positive that, but yet if we think there could have been someone else who assisted in these drawings, you know, who was Imhotep influenced by? You know, did he have all that in his head, or was he helped by anybody, or... You know what I'm saying? I've often wondered if he came up with that, I mean, the concept of that thing, because when you look at it, you know, the degree of the angle of the apex, if there's 51 degrees, I mean, it's set in the center of the earth. It would be like where the navel is on your body. You can't get it any more perfect than the middle of the earth. I mean, that's how does one man do that?
Hey, Joe, will we ever really find out how Leed Skolnin did what he did?
George, I'm asked that question all the time, and I'll tell you this. I think you boil it down basically to two things. He either did it with pulleys, which is kind of hard to figure out, or he levitated him. So if we've only got two ways, I think people are working on it, but I think in time it'll be discovered. Because like Hutchison, you know, that thing, I was amazed by how he's levitating these things. He can make buildings disappear. So I think that the realm that we're coming into now, this age, George, I think we'll find it in our lifetime.
All right, let's go next to our next wild card line. You're on the air with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there, Bob.
Hi. Bob from Gary, Indiana.
Okay, sir.
I had a question for Joe. I got through about a week or so ago and started to tell you a story and got cut off. I'm on my cell phone. When I was younger, my mother and I were traveling, and we both of us saw a plane. Found later it looked like a big World War II transport plane that they used in Berlin, transport supplies, big four-engine plane. And it looked somewhat translucent, almost kind of like what it would look like if it was in a black and white movie or something along those lines. And we went around a line of trees and could no longer see the plane. And then when we got around the other side of the trees, it was gone. Just totally disappeared. And it wasn't moving when we saw it. It was probably 150, 200 feet above the ground. And just wondered if maybe, and this was in central Illinois, wondered if maybe there had been any other cases of disappearances, things like of that nature that might correlate to the Bermuda Triangle somehow.
Wow. And it was in Illinois, you say, caller?
Yes, sir.
Bob? Wow. Yeah, I think that there's an area of Japan that's actually exactly opposite of our Bermuda Triangle, and they've had disappearances occur just like that. So maybe, you know, the caller earlier who said, hey, I think the Bermuda Triangle is bigger, other sightings have been done in other places. Most of it occurs in the Bermuda Triangle, but I'm like George. I would say anything's possible like that. And if you saw something like that, then it's got to be.
Did Ed Lead Skolnick ever say anything about seeing UFOs?
Not in my research. I think that he discussed them with Mr. Bullard at one time in the context of you know, life on other planets, just like we sit here and talk about it on your show, George. But as far as him ever experiencing or seeing it, he never mentioned it as far as experiencing one that I've seen in any research I've come across. I think he believed in them. I don't think he had any problem with life outside the planets because he was very open-minded. But I never saw where he experienced anything. He would certainly have, I don't know if he would have written that down or not, to tell you the truth.
Okay, next up, let's go to our first-time caller line. Hello, Chris, where are you calling from?
Hey, George. I'm calling from Tallahassee, Florida.
Okay, Chris, go ahead, sir.
Hey, how y'all doing out there?
Fine, man.
Hey, it's pretty hard to get a hold of these gardeners around here, man. I don't know. I had a question. I was wondering, do you know if he? I've been down there before. I've been down there before to the castle and everything. Like that. It's nice when I was younger and when I was in school. But I had a question. Do you think or do you know of him taking any herbal like remedies or anything like that? Like, or what was his diet or like, you know?
No. I don't have any anything like that. I do know that he used one time when he cut his hand. He used, and these were my old grandmother's remedies. But he cut his hand pretty bad on a tuna can, and he actually wrapped it with a spider's web because the bleeding was pretty bad. And that's how they used to stop the cuts in those days, with a spider web.
Yeah.
And
I don't know. He was pretty. He grew his own food. He was mainly just straight natural.
Right, mainly a vegetarian, and about the only meat he really ever ate was when he caught a rabbit, or and you know, church groups and stuff would come by on Sundays and they'd have picnics and bring him fried chicken. So he had a lot of friends. But as far as himself, you know, it's really, he just didn't care that much about. He was not a foodaholic. He ate enough to stay alive. But you got to remember, this guy only slept like 3 hours a day. Sometimes.
Yeah, that's the thing about it. That's the thing about it. How can he stay up so? And he did not smoke.
Nope. Didn't smoke. Didn't drink.
But he did was mainly just take cat naps.
That's exactly right. He'd get in his afternoon chairs. He'd read a little bit, cat nap, and he needed to get ready for work at night. And he'd go all day, and he'd quit at 6 when the sun started coming up, and he'd take a little nap then, eat a little breakfast.
Hey, I don't think he quit. He just laid there with his eyes closed, and he couldn't go to sleep. His mind was racing, I bet you.
Yeah, his brain was always working. That's a good point.
Yeah, that is a good point. That's something to think about. Hey, but just wanted to call. And George, hey, you're doing a good thing. Keep the world cleaner.
Well, you got it, Christopher. We'll do it. We'll do it. Let's go next, west of the Rockies. Hey, Rick, your turn.
Hi, this is Rick. I'm calling from Fort Irwin, California.
Okay.
North of Barstow, in the desert. Truck driver, listen to your program, love it. Try to call in many times. But tonight, I wanted to mention one thing and ask a question. I heard the guy talking about the underground gardens in Fresno.
Yeah.
And I live in Bakersfield, and I've been to those gardens.
What's it like? Is it, yeah, it must be strange, huh?
It's incredible. It's incredible what this guy did. I mean, I heard that he did it kind of to escape the heat. And he found, I mean, out there, Bakersfield gets pretty hot. Fresno gets hot, too. And he found a way of digging these tunnels down underneath. And there's like a little maze of tunnels to escape the heat. You're not down that deep, but you're deep enough to where the heat doesn't penetrate the ground. You're actually cooled off down there. He has little areas where you can actually almost, I mean, you could hang out and live down there for a while.
Caller, excuse me, how did he keep the walls from falling? Did he build up walls inside with lumber or stone? Or here in Florida, it's too wet. We could never, you know, we would drown. We can't dig tunnels where I'm at.
The ground's really hard and dry out here.
Okay.
Okay, I'm from Bakersfield. That's a little north. That's 2 hours north of where I'm at.
Okay.
But, yeah, it's not really that much of an issue. It's not like there's a lot of sand or moisture in the dirt. It's really hard. You have to get a pickaxe to actually break through the dirt.
Wow.
I mean, it's pretty hard dirt.
This guy's dead? He's not alive anymore, is he?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure if he's alive or not. But it's like that other guy out in the desert. You ever heard of Burrow Schmidt?
No, I haven't.
Well, there's a desert out here. I believe it's the Mojave. This guy, you talk about incredible. The guy in Fresno just did that in his own property, you know, in his yard, and made these gardens. This other guy lived out in the desert, like where no one would even think of living, probably, like an old miner or prospector. He dug a tunnel through a mountain, and it took him like 30 years or more to do it, okay, all by himself.
Jeez.
For years, just digging, and that tunnel is still there. You can walk through from one side to the other. Why he did it, who knows? But he dug a tunnel from one side to the other, and it's a tourist attraction. It's called the Burrow Schmidt Tunnel out in California. I believe it's the Mojave Desert. I haven't visited that yet, but I'm going to be going there pretty soon. It's pretty incredible, a feat, you know, taking a guy 30 years to dig through, 20, 30 years to dig through a tunnel or a mountain.
Those are great feature stories. I think what we'll do is have Lex on our feature stories do something on those underground gardens and maybe even this tunnel as well. That's pretty fascinating stuff, Joe.
That's awesome, man. I'm sitting here going, I'm ready to go to California.
Next up, let's go to our wild card line. You are on the air. No, that's east of the Rockies. Go ahead.
Hello.
Hi.
How are you doing?
My name's Tim from St. Louis.
Okay, Tim.
Hey, I missed the first 10 minutes of the show, so maybe you already covered it, but I got into Edward Lee Scanlon for a few years and did quite a bit of research on him. And as I recall, he started his career when he came to the United States as a cowhand.
That's correct.
Wyoming, I believe, wasn't it?
Yes, sir, that's correct, in Texas.
And spent 2 or 3, 4 years out there.
Right.
And then for some unknown reason, maybe you know, that he went to Florida.
His health. He was developing tuberculosis, and it became full-blown.
That seems like the worst place you could go.
Well,
usually they tell you to go to Phoenix, you know, or something like that.
Yeah, they just, one of the doctors I don't think they exactly diagnosed it, but they said, you got to get out of Texas. The dust or somehow was getting in his lungs.
Oh, I never thought of that. Yeah.
Yes, sir. Yeah, the windstorms and the sandstorms out there were killing him.
And the other question I had, you know, I read that book several times. I think it's called Sweet 16.
Yes, sir. Mm-hmm.
And I'm convinced that he deliberately confused that book, that Sweet 16 is a, I don't know, I don't think it has anything to do with a girlfriend or anything. I think he's disguising the...
Well, it actually
some kind of code there or something.
Yeah, I think there's a code there going on.
Well, what he did was he used it for two ways. There actually was a girl. All that is true. But what he did was after he was beaten up, after the agents or whoever beat him up, he then figured that he could no longer talk about his machine too much or anything. So then he decided to switch the story to the Sweet 16 and make it a love story and hide his scientific stuff under that. But she existed. She did jilt him. All of that is bona fide, verified, true.
Well, whatever it is, the mysteries of Coral Castle continue. And though, Joseph, we may never get the answers, I do believe secret governments have probably unraveled how he did this. And I think we're using it today.
I agree, George.
Hey, Joe, I want to thank you for being on the program. Give us your website real quickly, please.
Yes, sir. It's www, same as the book, waitingforagnes.com. And I don't mind giving my phone number if you want to call for an order on the book. The number is 386-752-1059.
And that's on your website as well?
That's on my website. You can find my phone number.
Very good. Thanks, Joe.
George, thank you much, and keep it up, man.
Okay. For Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesur, Ross Mitchell, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.